presentation deals with the car. We'll go through the historical background, the technological developments. We'll see the figures about the car production worldwide, and we'll discuss some energy and environmental impacts of the car, of the motor vehicles in general, and then we'll discuss electric cars, the new development in this on this topic. Well, the car, of course, it's one of the main revolutions, technological, economic revolutions of the 20th century. The car changed our lifestyle, our landscape, our economy. The landscape mostly through the road infrastructure, and the economy connected to the effort of producing vehicles, road vehicles. Most of our travel, short to medium distance travels, is made on the road by road vehicles, either cars or buses. You see the numbers for Italy, traffico totale interno di passeggeri, about 90%, maybe more, is done by road. And this is measured in terms of passenger kilometers. That means accounting for the load factor. That means a car that runs 10 kilometers with one person counts for 10. A car that runs 10 kilometers with two persons counts for 20. And a train that runs 10 kilometers with 100 persons counts 10 times 100, this means 1,000. So even if it is accounted by the load factor, and usually cars don't have a very high load factor, the number of passengers kilometers traveled by car is enormously high. That means that road vehicles are the most important, the preferred modes of transport for people. The same is true also for freight, but here we deal mostly with the cars or with people. Technological developments. The first passenger cars, passenger vehicles, were electric. It was very easy to equip a coach with a battery, have an electric motor, and that moves the wheels. 1904, we have here the picture of a German electric car, and at those times most of the cars were mostly electric. Next slides, car charging, electric car charging in Detroit, and Thomas Edison in Detroit with this better looking electric car in 1913. At that time there was also the initial production of the internal combustion engines cars. So the cars actually revolutionized our way of moving, our mobility. 1910, this is the Model T, the famous Model T by Ford, equipped with an internal combustion engine, and it is the first automobile that is mass produced and produced on assembly lines with completely interchangeable parts, marketed to the middle class. You see the numbers listed on the column, production from 10,000 rapidly to 170,000 4 years afterwards, reaching more than a million by 1922, so 13 years afterwards. And you see the prices go down thanks to the technological improvements and thanks to the economies of scale. Parallel to the development of the vehicle, you need to have a development of the roads and the vehicle of the petrol infrastructure, the fuel infrastructure, and that was built by companies such as the Standard Oil. After that, many more cars were constructed, both in the United States and in Europe, of different shapes and sizes, and also with different using different fuel types. So you have petrol, diesel, and gases like methane or LPG, liquid petroleum gas, and of course the electric cars, and more recently the hydrogen cars with fuel cells and hybrid cars. So having both an internal combustion engine and an electric motor. And here you see the graph of the production level worldwide of cars in million. And starting from 2000, you see a continuous increase in the production volumes, reaching almost 100 million vehicles, and continuously increasing. And of course, this is important for the economy, because this means a strong car manufacturing sector. The automotive industry is a major industrial economic force worldwide, because of the number of cars made, because of the number of people that are employees, and because of the strong linkages, heavy linkages with the supplier industry. In terms of employment, probably employment is decreased over time, because we went from a labor intensive sector to a capital intensive sector. This is the picture below, where you see that cars are made mostly by robots moved by computers, so machines that make other machines. And another aspect that is underlined in this picture, in this slide, is that the car industry has always a strong political influence in every country. Next slide is about the value chain. The auto manufacturing is at the center of this value chain, but before that there is the supply network. So the network that provides the raw material, like steel, aluminum and rubber, the components, transmission, brakes and seats, and these are sub-assembled in suspensions, chassis and engines, so the parts that go into the car itself. And then you have moving towards the customer, you have the marketing channel, the dealer network, and then the customers. And one thing that needs to be underlined for the cars is that cars are a highly customized product. Each customer wants his own car. He wants to choose the color, the seats, the wheels, and so they order a specific car, and that car has to be made wherever it asks for, worldwide, in the minimum time possible, so with the minimum lead time. And yes, that's an important feature that an automotive chain needs to supply. And this chain is organized worldwide. In fact, the next graph shows you a comparison between the production levels worldwide and the production levels in the United States, the country that invented and developed this vehicle. As you can see, that over the last 15 years, the share, the number of cars in the United States is almost constant, whereas worldwide is constantly increasing. Why is so? It's so because, as you see in the next slide, new countries started to building cars, and this is mainly, these new countries are mainly China and India. China went from 2 million cars in 2000 to 28 million cars in 2016, and India went from less than a million to almost 4 million and a half in 2016. So the cars are more and more built where the demand is, so that means in the developing countries. So you see that the number of cars built in the United States is stable, in Japan is stable, in Germany is stable, in Mexico it's also increasing from 2 million to 4 million, and that's due to the delocalization of the manufacturing, cars manufacturing, in this country with cheap labor at the border with the United States. You see also that Italy is actually declining from 1.7 million to 1 million only, and the same for France decline. Whereas in Slovakia, Eastern European countries actually increase, so the same reasoning. And interestingly, you see also that Russia, this very large country with almost 150 million population, has not yet entered into the market. It's still at 1 million cars produced in Russia. So I guess that most of the cars in Russia are imported. And what are the largest manufacturers? Well, you have here the list. The largest one in 2016 is Volkswagen with 9 million, and out of these 9 million, at least 3 million are built in China by joint ventures between a Chinese firm and Volkswagen. The same applies for Toyota, Hyundai, General Motors, that remain the largest manufacturers. And then there you have the list of all the others, and the one before the last is SAIC, that is actually a Chinese manufacturer that produces under his own brand 1.7 million cars. So China is mainly organized in small car manufacturers, but joint ventures and some brand names, some large brand names. Motor vehicle ownership 2013, you see the numbers, you see United States that after San Marino and Monaco is the country with the largest number of motor vehicles per population, almost more than 800 per 1,000 population. Australia is also has a large ownership level, and also Italy is pretty large. China, you see the second column, China is 188. And India is 41. That means that there is still a lot of unsatisfied demand for vehicles in less developed countries. So that means that we should expect that the number of vehicles produced worldwide will further increase. In fact, on the left hand side of the slide, you see the rate of increase, and you see China that has a 23% rate of increasing car ownership. What does that mean in terms of energy and environmental impact? Well, in terms of energy, that means that we are going to need more and more energy for mobility. These are the numbers that I've taken from a presentation by our rector Fermelia, that tells us that 2010, 15 terawatt per year were consumed worldwide, and these are going to go to 23 and 32 in the next years. And the next slide is about how we went in the second war period from an energy consumption of about 1 terawatt to an energy consumption of 12 terawatt. So it means very, very rapidly. And what were the sources? Where did we get this energy from? Well, as you can see, mostly coal, oil, a large part of it oil, natural gas, some hydro and renewables, and nuclear. So fossil fuels basically spurred this, allowed us to increase such consumption in energy. The next slide, always by Farmelia, tells us that in the future, the next years are going probably to have the same picture. More energy will be needed and more sources will be needed. Any kind of sources, nuclear, renewables, natural gas, coal, and oil liquids. What does this mean in terms of supply and demand? Well, oil comes from oil reserves, oil wells, and this need to be discovered. And as you can see, up to the 70s, the discovery of oil wells was quite abundant, but then it declined. And after 2010, the yellow bars, it is expected that not very many new sources of oil will be found, will be discovered. On the contrary, the production of oil, the extraction of oil, increased rapidly to satisfy these demand needs, as the black line suggests, and the red spots suggest what will be the production levels, the production request for the next years. So we are going to have an imbalance between supply, availability of oil on the one hand, and the production of oil, demand of oil on the other hand. So that, to an economist, that suggests that the price of oil is going to increase. Is that so? Well, we have two pictures here of depicting how the price of oil change. The first one goes up to 2011 and shows a constant level of price up to the 70s, then an increase due to mostly to the wars, to the military wars that took place in the oil producing countries. Then there was again a drop, so an increase in production and a drop of price. And from in the year 2000 to the year 2011, you have this sharp increase in price. That is also due, of course, to the cartel between the oil producing countries. After the 2011 and 14, maybe 14, you had a sharp decrease again in price that went down to almost $30 per barrel, and now is up again to $51 per barrel. This is the last quotation that is available. So what can we see? We see a fluctuation of the price, probably with a decreasing trend, but it fluctuates because the price reflects what's taking place at the political and economic level. The next slide is about the transport share of energy consumption. And here you can see the transportation consumes 28% of the energy globally requested, 20% by the industry, 21% by the industry, 11% by residential and commercial activities, and 40% by electric power. But if you look at the arrow from right to left, you see that most of the energy needs in transportation are satisfied by oil, by petroleum, 93%. Only 3% by natural gas and 4% by renewable energy, by electricity. So going through from left to right, you can also see that petroleum goes 71% to transportation. Okay. So there is a strong link between transportation needs and oil and petroleum. And distinguishing in the next slide between personal and commercial transportation, so moving people and moving, so light duty vehicles and moving freight, heavy duty vehicles. You see this among, it's about in 2015, it's about 50%. So about 20, 25, maybe 22 millions of oil equivalent barrels were consumed for by light duty vehicles, and about the same, maybe more, by commercial vehicles, by trucks. So those. So to summarize, we're going to have we are going to still to see an increase in vehicles, the number of vehicles produced and used by the population to satisfy its mobility needs. At the same time, this is going to create more energy demand, and that means that more oil demand, and but oil is scarce, and prices are probably going to go up. So what's going to happen? It's unclear. Next, let's focus on the environmental impact. So let's focus on local pollutants, noise, and CO2 emissions. Here, the air quality in Europe, the 2016 report states that more than 80% of the people living in urban areas that monitor air pollution are exposed to air quality levels that exceed the WHO limits, World Health Organization limits. What are these limits? They are linked, they are listed in this table, and the second column is the EU reference value, so the value that should not be exceeded. But you can see on the last column the percentage of people that are exposed to exceeding levels, the set levels exceeding the suggested level. So cities, European cities, suffer poor air quality. They also suffer from another problem due to vehicle and road transportation. They suffer from noise, high noise level, both during the day exceeding 55 decibel and during the night. So these are two main issues connected to road transportation. Then there is the last issue, that is CO2 emissions. You know, this is a well-known issue connected to greenhouse gases emissions. So greenhouse gases are all kinds of gases that create this greenhouse effect in the atmosphere. And this is a very recent graph produced by the Netherlands Environment Assessment Agency that shows that worldwide we are still increasing the number, the quantity of CO2 that we emit. Recently went up to 49%. The rate in increase is not, is very, is low. It's not high. It's less than 1%, but we're still increasing the level. So we are not reducing the level of CO2 emission, we're still increasing it. And transport accounts for 20% of this overall increase. So then I have some slides that on this issue that I borrow from the slides presented by Filippo Giorgi, an Italian physicist working at the Abdus Salam ICTP in Trieste. And he dealt with two questions. One is global warming happening? And if yes, is global warming due to human activities? First state that fluctuations in the temperature has always been present in the history of the Earth. So going back 400,000 years, there has been periods of glacial and interglacial fluctuations of temperature due to small variations in the Earth's orbit. But the Industrial Revolution, the ability to derive energy from fossil fuels, increased the amount of CO2 produced by the human being. And this creates this greenhouse effect. What is the greenhouse effect? Greenhouse gases absorb the infrared radiation emitted by the surface of the Earth and re-emit it in all directions, including downwards, thereby warming up the atmosphere and the oceans. And these are the main greenhouse gases that include, the most famous one is CO2. What's the problem? The problem is this is a natural phenomenon. This the radiation, the incoming solar radiation, goes back to the space, but it's also partly retained and re-emitted towards the Earth. But the increase in greenhouse gases increase the proportion of radiations that is redirected downwards, and this increases the temperature, the global temperature. So the next graph is about the increase in CO2 emissions in the last years, sharp increase. And so the answer that he gives to the first question, is global warming happening? The answer is definitely yes, unequivocally yes. And the proofs, the evidence is global temperature has increased by 1 degree in the last 100 years, melting of glacier and snow, melting of Arctic ice, sea level rise, heat absorption by the oceans. But then there is the more difficult question, is global warming due to human activities? Since global warming can be due to human factors and natural factors. Human factors are greenhouse gases, the emission of greenhouse gases, as we've seen, atmospheric aerosols, also a product of carbon dusting, and land use changes, for example, the reduction of the amount of earth devoted to forest. Natural factors are volcanic activity, variations of solar radiations, and natural variability. What the climatologists do is they model these factors, they combine the factors, and they try to predict and to fit their results with the data. So here you see on the black line are the observations, how the world temperature went. And you see this sharp increase in the last 20 years. And the models with natural forcing, that means only with the variables connected to the natural sources, would predict a still fluctuating, but with a rather constant, with a constant trend variability. On the contrary, when the models include the human forces, so the CO2 emissions, basically, then they are able to fit much better the data, and so they conclude that with 95% probability, certain they are not certain, with 95% probability, the increase in global warming of the last years is due to the increase in greenhouse gases of anthropogenic origin. Okay, so that's the evidence about the energy and environmental impact. Okay, let's stop here.